This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than just a car or a house. It's the four wheels that get you where you're going and the four walls that welcome you home. When you combine auto and home insurance with Amica, we'll help protect it all. And the more you cover, the more you can save. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
This is the Ion Travel Podcast with CBS News travel editor Peter Greenberg.
Hi there, everybody. Peter Greenberg here with another edition of the Ion Travel Podcast. This week, from the Presidential Library in Hyde Park, New York, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Not every U.S. president has a library, and the FDR Library is not only the first of its kind, but the only one opened while the president was actually still president, way back in 1941. An amazing collection of history, lessons learned, lessons applied, and of course, great storytelling. I sat down with Bill Harris, who runs the library, for a short course on that remarkable history. Then we'll move to the CIA. No, not America's super secret intelligence agency, but the one located nearby the library, the other CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, which was founded back in 1946, even before the other CIA became the CIA most people think they know. Director Tim Ryan is in charge of this CIA secrets. And then, legendary NBC correspondent and creator of The American Story on the Today Show, and master storyteller Bob Dodson. He joins me to talk about storytelling and history, what's really important and who's really important. He's got a new book out as well, Make It Memorable. And, spoiler alert, he does. First up, from the FDR Library, Bill Harris.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first 3 orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Bill Harris, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me today.
How many presidential libraries are there?
Oh, my. You're asking me a numbers question right off the bat. Since Herbert Hoover, FDR was the first presidential library, but Herbert Hoover forward has a presidential library.
So there's Hoover, there's Roosevelt, there's Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm. Everyone.
There's Truman. Right?
All the way up through Obama, which hasn't opened yet.
Right. So, what, 9 or 10 of them?
13, I think.
Oh, my goodness. And you know what I found interesting? Is if you go to the Nixon Presidential Library, they even have exhibits on Watergate.
Yes, they do. In fact, I was involved in bringing that private museum into the National Archives in my Washington years. I'm very familiar with the Nixon Library.
And amazing place. The George W. Bush Presidential Library on the campus of SMU in Dallas. Amazing place.
It is. It's beautiful. I was fortunate enough to be involved in the establishment of that one as well.
See, we're going to do your entire life story now. And then out in California, the Reagan Library.
Beautiful.
Well, they have actually the 707. Air Force One is in the building.
That's right.
And on a permanent static display. When he was president, I had the opportunity to fly with him on Air Force One.
Fascinating.
And so when I went back to visit the library and the museum, I asked the curators there if they could do me a favor, and they did. They let me back in the plane.
Oh, nice.
So I could sit in my original seat and take a picture.
That's great.
I mean, I know it sounds hokey, but I had to do it.
Absolutely.
You know? Absolutely. This was really the first presidential
Absolutely.
Library. And it was, of course, the first president, not of course, it was the first presidential library that opened while the president was still president.
It's actually the only presidential library that opened while the president was president. And we don't have an Oval Office because we don't need one. We've got the office he actually worked in while president here at the library and gave radio addresses from, right in the building down the hall from my office.
That's right. And radio like we're doing today.
Absolutely.
Bigger microphones, though.
But the CBS logo is on them just as well.
Oh, I love it. I love it. But this is his home as well.
Correct. What makes this place even doubly more special is that he was born and raised here, and the site of the library is carved out that he picked the measurements for the 16 acres that was handed over to the National Archives in 1940. So we're very much a part of his property and his whole personal experience.
I think it's an understatement that Roosevelt had a sense of history.
Oh, it is. He had a tremendous sense not only of history, but also, as presidents tend to, of his place in that history and of, I would say, the period of time. He recognized that they were extraordinary and that it would be important to be able to study that.
One of the fascinating things to me, not about American history or World War II or the New Deal or anything he's associated with, is how the news media was basically gagged on his physical disability.
I would say maybe not as much gagged as participatory in the... Yes, I would say that it was a mutual relationship of...
If you wanted access to the president, you had to play along.
Well, you did play along. That's absolutely right. And, of course, we can debate that. We do here today about
Have you ever found photographs of him actually in the wheelchair?
Oh, absolutely. There are not that many, but we certainly have some.
You have his car on the premises here, too.
We do, and I would say in terms of the wheelchair, he didn't like being in the wheelchair. The wheelchair was just moving him from one place to another so he could be transferred to a chair such as in his office. But we do have his car, especially outfitted Ford.
Right, with hand controls for the accelerator and the brakes?
That's right, as well as a device that dispensed a lit cigarette.
A lit cigarette?
A lit cigarette.
Wow, an invention that thankfully did not catch on.
Indeed.
When people come to this library, what's the thing that surprises them the most?
I think what does surprise them is how interwoven it is to the physical landscape and the personal life story of the president. 50 yards from the library is the home he was born and raised in, that his mother lived in until 1941. 25 yards away from our building is his gravesite and Mrs. Roosevelt's. In his mother's rose garden. We are surrounded by and a part of the land that he played on as a child, that he loved as an adult, and that he tended with a real thought about the environment and the physical spaces.
And then there's, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes, absolutely. She, you know, spent her married life here, but also a home of her own was constructed about 2 miles to the east here on what was a state property. That's Fallkill. And so she spent a great deal of time there. And after the president's death, once the home had been turned over to the National Park Service in 1946, she made her permanent residence other than an apartment in New York City here.
You know, you show a movie in the auditorium here, and I saw it today. And what I was struck by, and people don't remember Eleanor Roosevelt's role in civil rights.
Oh, well, we have a special exhibit running right now that addresses just that. She was very forward-thinking in her approach to social justice and her recognition recognition of each individual's human dignity. And it is very contemporary, her views and approach, and they were frankly much farther ahead than her husband's or the administration's.
I mean, the Ku Klux Klan had a bounty on her head. Marian Anderson was going to sing at the Daughters of the American Revolution, and they banned her from it. And what did Eleanor Roosevelt do? This is classic.
It's really quite remarkable. She resigned her membership in the Daughters of the American Revolution.
And what year was this?
1939.
I mean, think about that.
Yes, it's remarkable. In a very public gesture, actually very polite but pointed public gesture. And then she arranged to have Marian Anderson perform a concert on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. So drawing even more attention not only to the fact that the DAR ran a segregated facility, but that that talent and her dignity transcended the narrow and limited views of the time.
I mean, given that it was 1939, for one, and America's political stature at that time, I'm amazed that even Eleanor could pull that off.
It is remarkable, and you see constantly through the records, through her radio, she had multiple radio programs, one on CBS, in fact.
She wrote a weekly column.
And she wrote a weekly newspaper column. And you see her advocating, meeting with people and advocating far beyond what the administration was prepared to do politically.
Comfortable.
That's absolutely right.
Or uncomfortable.
Yes.
Exactly. The exhibits that you have here, it's sort of like, you know, the Reagan Library has an exhibits every once in a while on Iran-Contra. George W. Bush on Iran and Iraq. And all the stuff that you would think is like, you know, off limits. Yeah. But we're actually taking a look at our own history.
It's really important that we do that. The way I like to frame it is we had the courage to overcome the Great Depression as a nation and to defeat fascism around the world during World War II. So surely we have the strength of character to explore the really tough aspects of our American history and take a hard look at ourselves and what our own roles were and learn from it and grow, not to tear things down, but to frankly acknowledge the patriotic American citizens who fought for and wanted their place in our society.
And of course, the little-known personal stories as well.
Absolutely, because those personal stories, I think, are what really connect us to the past. The past is much more real when you realize that we're just part of a long continuum of it. So you see this transformation over time, the transition on different paths of the president and the first lady, just taking questions of civil rights and racial justice. They're on different paths, and they're progressing at different speeds and in different ways, but you're seeing this arc of people who are changing. And that means if these historical figures were human enough to make mistakes, acknowledge them, and grow and change over time, then we're exactly the same way.
You know, I was not alive at that point when he was doing his fireside chats, but my parents would tell me that they would gather around the radio. I mean, everybody would gather around the radio as a family unit to listen to the father figure, otherwise known as the President of the United States.
Yes, think about it in 1933 terms. Of course, President Hoover had spoken on the radio, but not in a way that would connect, in a much more formalized way of giving speeches. When the president sat down to speak with people over the radio, which was the only national, you know, immediately available public communication source outside of newspapers, he did so in a way that was very human. He did not speak down to people. He spoke to people to include them in issues, to include them in gaining understanding of really complex things like the American banking system, which was in a state
of collapse.
By the
way, we're still confused about that.
Absolutely. He sat down, though, and was able to talk to people about what it meant to them in terms of saving their money, it being in the bank, it being safe, and what the impact of pulling your money out, what the impact of failing banks meant. So the ability to connect with people, here's a man, we're here on his beautiful estate, a wealthy man from the Northeast, and yet he's able, through this means of radio, to communicate people on a very human level.
And when you think of the man he succeeded, Herbert Hoover, who presided over one of the worst economic pieces of history in American history, what he had to do in a short period of time, right? The New Deal, the Tennessee Valley Authority, all the dam construction, all that stuff happened because he had people behind him to say, okay, we'll do it.
I think what's remarkable, and that what people forget, or maybe aren't aware of anymore, is the truly dire nature of the nation in the winter and spring of 1933.
50% unemployment.
We were nearly in a state of total economic collapse. And what the president had also, which not many presidents have had for quite a long time,
were
super majorities in both houses of Congress. So he came in with a clear mandate to tackle, experiment, try out new things, to try to effect some sort of change. And they did exactly that, bold experimentation.
My thanks to Bill. Not far from the FDR Library is another great destination in the Hudson Valley, the CIA. No cloak and dagger here, but knives are often involved. It's the other CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, and Tim Ryan stops by to reveal some of its very cool secrets.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, sir.
Peter, it's great to be here.
I mean, explain the CIA because, not the CIA in Langley. Explain the CIA in Hyde Park.
Well, yeah, the first thing is we were first. So my CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, was founded in 1946. Central Intelligence Agency, 1947.
After the OSS.
That's right. So we're number one in that regard. We were founded at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, by the local restaurant association there, who knew that there was going to be a post-war need for highly trained people for the burgeoning restaurant industry. And they brought in Mrs. Frances Roth, who was an assistant district attorney in New Haven.
Wow.
First woman in Connecticut to be...
And a foodie.
a foodie. First woman in Connecticut to be admitted to the bar. And she recruited her friend, Catherine Angel, who was the wife of the president of Yale. And so it was for that reason that we opened under the auspices of Yale University in New Haven. And with the GI Bill, we educated returning veterans from the Second World War. So that was a wonderful start. We did that until the 1970s down there, early 1970s, when we were busting at the seams. We had a 14-acre campus right within the Yale's campus, and we could no longer contain the growth. So we found a wonderful spot here in the Hudson Valley.
That's the former monastery.
It's the former Jesuit seminary called St. Andrews on Hudson. And so now we have about 180 acres of property there, perched high above the Hudson's banks. That's part of our alma mater, by the way.
Not bad.
Yeah.
I mean, I should tell my audience that I can't go to a major chef anywhere in the world. At least 80% of them tell me they're CIA alums.
That's right. And we're proud of that. And of course, you and I have a lot of mutual friends, too. So you know most of the people that I know.
Which we just discovered about 10 minutes
That's
ago.
That's right. That's right.
But you know, in the hotel industry, people go to Cornell, but in the food and cooking industry, in the chef industry, it's the CIA.
That's right. Yeah.
What are you teaching there?
Well, first of all, what we teach has changed greatly over the years to follow pace with the industry. Actually, you know, we've probably led the industry in a lot of things. So we started out as a little training school. It was actually a 9-week program just focused on culinary arts. Over the years, we grew to offer associate's programs just in the culinary arts. Then we added a baking and pastry program. Now we have bachelor's degree programs in those two disciplines, culinary arts, baking and pastry arts, but hospitality management, food science, wines and spirits, and a host of other things, and now master's programs. So you can get a master's degree in hospitality, in business, in entrepreneurship, in wines. And we just announced recently the first ever master's degree in culinary arts. And it'll start in September. Free tuition, sponsored by Dom Perignon, the great champagne house. And students, while they're studying...
Stop right there.
I know.
Stop right there. I can't wait to tell somebody I got a Dom Perignon scholarship.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So you're a Dom Perignon scholar, and while you're going to school, the academic classes at the CIA, you're also embedded in Michelin three-star restaurants, either the French Laundry or Single Thread in Healdsburg, California. So phenomenal thing, and another step forward in the evolution of our profession.
Of course, not that long ago, people described American cuisine as what? Hot dogs and hamburgers.
That's exactly right. And actually, it was that's the reason I came to the CIA. I graduated from the CIA, but then I came back as a faculty.
But you did not have a Dom Perignon scholarship.
I did not. I came back as a faculty member in the early 80s to launch an American cuisine initiative, and we opened a restaurant, the American Bounty, which was really at the forefront of that whole American cuisine movement. But you're exactly right. You know, back then when we said that we're going to open an American restaurant, we're going to start to train CIA students in American cuisine, even Americans within the industry said, what is that?
Hot dogs and hamburgers? All they wanted was French. Yeah, all they wanted was French.
French, maybe some Italian, but French was the predominant. That's exactly right. But you flash forward to today, and of course, American cuisine, nobody questions it. Nobody's going to challenge it. But it was a hard road to hoe there for quite a few years.
I mean, wherever I go in the world now, it's not necessarily Paul Bocuse. Wherever I go in the world now, someone's serving lobster mac and cheese.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, by the way, Paul Bocuse, who was a good friend, and I worked for him in my youth, his son, Jerome, is a graduate of the CIA. And Paul came to the Institute. He knew us well, made a big speech, said, this is the finest school in the world, and I'm going to send my son here.
And he did.
He did, and it sent shockwaves through France. They immediately sent the Minister of Education to the CIA to see what the heck was going on. And then they brought us to France to do an assessment.
Although I will say, if you go to Lyon, you got to go see his restaurant.
You absolutely do. It is.
It's still there.
It sure is. I was there this February. It's recently been refurbished. Jerome Bocuse now runs the operation, and it's fantastic. A must visit.
When I was at Newsweek magazine, this is where I got a chance to date myself. When I was at Newsweek magazine, we put him on the cover. We put Paul Bocuse on the cover.
August of 1976, I have that framed in my office.
Yes, sir.
That was huge.
Well, if you have the actual magazine, you'll see all my other stories that are in there, too.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
I'll never forget. I think that was the first time, at least in my entire tenure at Newsweek, that we put a chef on the cover.
It was such a huge deal, and I'll tell you what. I remember it because I was about to come as a student to the CIA. And, you know, I had told my parents, and they were very supportive of that. But when a chef was then on the cover of Newsweek magazine, I could show that to them and look, Mom, Dad, look, there's a chef on the cover of Newsweek.
Yeah, that never happened. I'm telling you, never.
Yeah.
Wow. And that turned things around.
It sure did. Yeah.
It was like tantamount to when we put Bruce Springsteen on the cover and nobody had ever heard of him.
That's right. The future of rock and roll.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Another one.
Yeah.
So what's the most difficult course?
Well, the most difficult course, well, that's so students at the CIA take not just cooking courses. They take a bunch of business courses, and they also take liberal arts general education courses. So we provide them a well-rounded education.
You know, when you talk about business courses,
yeah.
This is going to come as no surprise to you. I, like every other male, always had the dream of opening a restaurant, right? I know nothing. So I know what I like, and I know what food I'd like to serve. I have no idea how to price anything. I have no idea what's of value. I have no idea how to make a profit. I would be bankrupt in 18 minutes. So the business course you're telling them is, here's how much you have to charge for something based on the ingredients, too.
And, you know, here's how you have to handle your human resources function and marketing and social media. And, you know, the business has become increasingly complex. And so our curriculum has kept pace with that. So it depends on the student's disposition. You know, some of the business courses, some of the general ed courses may be more difficult. But within the realm of their discipline, the one that they often find the most difficult is a mandatory course we have in wines, because you know, there's a lot of memorization, there's a lot of regions, and there's a lot of grape varietals to remember, and so on. So,
you know, what kind of scholarship do I get for that?
We do have scholarships.
Oh, here it comes. Sponsored by who?
As well, Charmer's Sun Belt Group, Breakthrough Beverages, Wine Spectator. A whole bunch. There's a whole bunch.
Are there courses that just I can go and take as a short course?
There are. People are very interested in visiting the CIA and experiencing it. Actually, we're one of the largest tourist destinations here in Dutchess County. And we encourage everybody to come by. We have restaurants that the students run as part of their studies, that like the Paul Bocuse restaurant. You talked about Paul Bocuse. We have the Caterina de' Medici restaurant, the American Bounty restaurant, the Apple Pie Bakery Cafe, and then we have seasonal pop-ups that happen. And then some people want to take courses. So you can take a one-day, a three-day, a five-day boot camp, a total immersion into the CIA. They're very, very popular.
So you can sign me up for bakery and pastry.
Okay, you've got it. And like yourself, we have lots of celebrities come and take them. Ryan Seacrest flies his helicopter in and takes courses at the CIA.
Come on.
Very, very frequently. He's a great guy, very passionate about food. Reese Witherspoon, Cameron Diaz, Tyra Banks have all taken courses, and many more at the CIA.
It's always amazing to me, because you're always learning and you're always developing. What's the one thing, since you offer so many of these different courses, what's the thing that most people, whether they're chefs or restaurateurs, operators, classically forget to do, which makes the difference between success and failure?
Well, the number one thing would just be season. So the difference between typically a novice cook and a real professional is the ability to season properly. And so that's the number one thing.
You know what? I have one for you. Too many sauces.
Well, my number one would be, other than seasoning, lack of basic fundamentals. So it makes a big difference if you know your knife cuts, so you know how to use a knife. It makes a big difference if you know how to sear a piece of meat before you finish roasting it in a pan, or to glaze a pan to make a delicious sauce. There's basic fundamentals. People oftentimes, they want to, well, in everything. If you want to be a golfer, people want to do fancy things before they learn the basic fundamentals. And the same is true in cooking. You have to master the basic fundamentals, and then you can build from there. And so the boot camp classes that we offer really help people to master those basics.
Here's what I've mastered. By the way, this is called trial and error. I used to think I was a pretty good barbecue guy. And then I realized I was making a big mistake. So if you're going to do fish, the fish cooks so fast that if you don't bake it first and then put it on the grill just to finish it off, you have a burned fish on the outside and no fish cooked on the inside. I learned that. Ribs, I literally bake them at 250 degrees for 20 minutes on each side, heavily marinated. I marinate them for 3 hours first. Then I put them on the grill.
Right.
Right. People just throw stuff on the grill are missing an essential process.
Oftentimes. You know, to your point, we have a book called Low and Slow that's all about that very principle that you just talked about. Yeah, very important.
I often, you know, categorize a successful chef by how much they spend in prep as opposed to just cooking.
So probably one of the most oft-uttered phrases at the CIA, something that's being talked about day in and day out, is mise en place. And that's the French term for everything in its place, the constant state of preparation. And it's a life-changing skill that we teach all of our students. They could come in a disorganized mess, but they're going to walk out and their parents are going to say, what did you do to Little Peter. This is a completely different guy than we said here. And part of the reason why is we teach how important that preparation is. Preparation is everything is one of our big sayings.
Now, I'm one of those guys who defines airline food as an oxymoron. Have any airline chefs come to work with you?
Over the years, we've done consulting with a lot of the airlines, not post-COVID, and having been on airplanes a lot lately, I can tell you they've taken a step back.
They've taken four steps back.
Well, I was being kind, but I agree. I've had some, even in the business class, horrendous food on airlines lately.
I mean, if the only thing you're looking forward to in terms of culinary on an airplane is a Biscoff cookie, because you know they can't mess that up,
right,
there's something wrong.
Yeah. Maybe you'll agree with me too, because you travel a lot and are obviously an expert, but even the level of service has gone way, way back. You could barely get a drink. You can barely get service. It's, you know, when they say safety is our number one priority, that's true, but it also means don't expect much in terms of service.
So they can operate the escape slide, but don't think you can order something medium rare.
Yeah, there's a big opportunity on airlines today. I agree they've stepped back.
Exactly. But, since you're doing boot camp, you should do an airline boot camp.
At one time we did. An airline sent their
flight attendants. By the way, when you talk about airline service, you can always start the sentence with the three words, at one time. But not now.
That's probably true.
Unbelievable. Tim Ryan, the president of the Culinary Institute of America, a pleasure to have you with us. And I can't wait to come into the bakery and baking and pastry boot camp.
Please come and see us.
My thanks to Tim. And then, I always enjoy sitting down with Bob Dotson, one of the master storytellers of Network News. Many of you might remember Bob for his long-running and now legendary American Story series on the Today Show. He has a new book out, Make It Memorable, which allows us to figure out what story and whose story really makes a difference. Bob, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Peter.
Now, in the 40 years you did that for NBC and the Today Show, did you ever figure out how many miles you did?
Well, when I retired, they figured it all up, and they said I had done 4 million actual miles in the United States alone, reporting stories about seemingly ordinary people who had done something to change our lives for the better, mostly.
You know, when I talk to people, I always, and they ask me what, you know, how I approach a story, I always do it the same way, especially if it's a large group of people in the room. I ask one person to come up on stage, and I ask that person to look around the room and take their time. Start at the very left, go all the way to the far right. And when they're done, I say, okay, tell me, by the way, there are no wrong answers. I say, tell me what you see. Well, I see people. Yep, you do see people. I see men and women. Yep, absolutely correct. And some of them look interesting, right? Absolutely. And some of them are dressed in sweaters or jackets and ties. Very good. That's exactly what you saw. Let me tell you what I see. I see 73 fascinating stories waiting to be told. Now, they may not be all great storytellers, but that doesn't mean they don't have a fascinating story. And that's where, if you're a good journalist, you come in, and you meaning Bob Dotson. That's why that ran for 40 years.
Well, I think the most overlooked portion of our society is the rest of us. You know, celebrities, they get all the storytelling they want because they've got organizations that build their stories and put them onto television, radio stations, and what have you. And, you know, certainly, you know, sports figures have their day in the sunshine. But over and over, as I went around the country, I realized there's all kinds of folks, as you just mentioned, who have great stories that are overlooked. And if we just stop and ask a question, instead of, you know, jumping out of our cars when we're on vacation and, you know, seeing something and taking a picture of it, I say stop and ask a question. And then maybe somebody will give you an insight into how to tell that story or to show those pictures to your people back home that in such a way that's as memorable to them as it was to you when you took the picture. I'll give you a quick case in point. There was a fellow down in Mississippi who was restoring an old car, and all of the folks in a coffee shop told me I ought to go see him because he's really good with his hands. And by the way, the car is as old as you are. I said, oh, okay, fine. So I went down the road and I started to talk to him, and I asked him a non-question question. And what I mean by this, and this is a tip that any of your listeners can use, people always answer questions in three parts. They give you the answer they think you've asked for, then they explain their answer, and if you wait just a little bit and don't jump right in, they figure, well, they haven't explained it well enough. So they go, well, dummy, that's why I killed my wife. Well, you didn't even know they were a murderer, but now you do. Well, anyway, so I'm down there with this guy who is restoring this old car, and I use that technique on him. And suddenly I found this story that was so much more fascinating because it told us how he had changed the world but didn't have time to tweet and tell us about it or go on television and run for president or write a book. This is the case. He was an out-of-work truck driver. He ended up in downtown Detroit, and he got a job cleaning medical tools at the University of Michigan Med Center. And he watched these students who were trying to learn surgery working on mice back in the early 1960s, and all their tools were too big. Now, this guy was in his 40s. He goes back home after taking some of their books home and reading them for 6 months, goes into his garage, comes back. He was one of the first people to invent microsurgery tools.
Wow.
And then, because people didn't know how to use them, they asked him to teach them. So if you graduate next year from the University of Michigan Med Center as the outstanding student, you get your name on a plaque with Jim's face. Jim Crudup is his name. And he never finished high school. Well, now, you know, in the great scope of things, you'd say, well, why would I even bother with a guy like that? You know, his friends say he's good with his hands. Well, because he's restoring a car. And you figure that's all there is to him? Well, there's not. There's this great story. And he's just overlooked because he looks like your uncle or he looks like my brother or whatever. And yet those people are the reason America is still functioning. Not necessarily the politicians or the people on Twitter. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
there's
people below that level, you know, we hear every day in the media. And these people are quietly solving problems that we all face.
And your advice is well taken because, you know, when you think about it, you know, we're sorely lacking the art of conversation these days. And, you know, when people travel, you know, the suggestion that you just gave is exactly what they should embrace every time they're in a new city, a new town, or even if they're returning to a place they think they know. Chances are they don't know enough, and you should stop and talk to people, and don't ask questions that could be answered by yes or no.
Let them fill the silence.
Exactly. And all of a sudden, not only do you learn stuff, in many cases, and I'm sure that happened to you in all of your stories, but maybe not all of them, Bob, but many of them, you end up with lifelong relationships and friendships that even lead to other discoveries and an exchange of ideas. It's the best way to do it.
Well, you know, most journalists, they get their ideas from people who are in the field that they're covering. If you're covering politics, politicians feed you stories and that sort of stuff, medicine, certain things, sports. In my case, you're absolutely right. People who I did stories on or met while I was on a story ended up, in some cases, lifelong friends and fed me the kinds of things that they knew that I would be interested in. And they supported my career for years. And that's exactly the case. I mean, there's a little town, for instance, called Phillipsburg, Montana. Some of the people that were out west this summer wandering around, they might have bumped into it. It's about 75 miles south of Missoula. It's one of those gorgeous old gold and copper towns, mining towns that have been restored. And so it gets a lot of travelers in there. But once again, I asked a question when I was walking downtown, and I said, I noticed when I read a little background of this area that there are 29 ghost towns in this county. How come Phillipsburg's not a ghost town? Well, instead of running around just taking pictures of all the beautiful things downtown, suddenly somebody said, well, you know what we did? There are only 900 people in this town, but we decided we'd start a thrift store. And when we were through with something, we'd go down and put it up for sale. And then when we wanted something, we'd go to the thrift store first. And that's how we were able to keep our hospital open. Then we started an opera in the old opera house. Same way. And one of those questions that are not a question where the fellow filled in the silence, he said, That's how they saved my life. Well, it turned out his name was Mike Cutler, and he needed a stem cell transplant. He was superintendent of schools, all right? So he goes off fishing one day. He comes home. There's a tent over Main Street, little town, beautiful little town. He goes into the tent. They present him with a $40,000 check, right? So you wonder how these people survived. Well, they decided that they all loved living in Phillipsburg, but if they didn't take care of each other, there would be no Phillipsburg.
A great
story.
Isn't
that the core of America? I mean, really?
Well, you would like to think that it is, and by the way, my experience proves your point, too. It's happened to me that way. By the way, we're talking to Bob Dodson, legendary broadcaster, correspondent for NBC News for more than 40 years, and the author or the co-author of Make It Memorable. Of course, the subtitle might seem misleading for a travel show, but it's not. It's the same technique. It's writing and packaging visual news with style. So this is how you travel with style, ladies and gentlemen. You ask questions. You engage in conversation, and you just not only might learn something, you might also teach somebody else. And the next thing you know, this exchange of ideas leads to all sorts of things that you didn't plan. And when you say plan, this is how I deal with travel. My best experiences, Bob, maybe you had the same, is when the plan didn't work. My best experience is when I turned left when I should have turned right, and it changed everything, right?
Sometimes you have to get lost to find yourself.
My thanks to Bob, to Bill Harris, and to Tim Ryan. And my thanks to you for listening to this Eye on Travel podcast. For more conversations with the world's leaders in travel, as well as answers to your travel questions, be sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And for all the breaking travel news, you know the drill. Just log on to petergreenberg.com.
The Eye on Travel podcast is produced by Amanda Morris and Anthony Protis Chung. For more content from Peter Greenberg and the Eye on Travel team, visit petergreenberg.com. Eye on Travel is a production of CBS News Radio.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary and it's not boring. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and maybe more importantly, on your life. I'm going to be your financial coach, someone who brings common sense and an insider's perspective on how to manage your money and your emotions. And I promise we are going to have a little bit of fun along the way. Have a question from retirement to career changes to college funding? Just send us an email at askjill@jillonmoney.com. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
The Hargan women seem to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene,
there were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
It was the biggest scandal in pop music. The stars of Milli Vanilli, the Grammy-winning multi-platinum R&B phenomenon, were exposed as frauds. But none of this was their idea. So whose idea was it? Enter German music producer Frank Farian. He saw the success of acts like Michael Jackson and Prince, and he wanted in, no matter the cost. So he devised the perfect pop heist. Two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? They couldn't sing. But Frank knew just how to fix that. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies and takes a never-before-heard look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when the truth came out, Rob and Fab were the only ones who got burned. Looking back now, it's hard not to wonder, why did everyone blame them and not the man pulling the strings? Follow Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.